Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, April 6, 2018. South Sudan Embassy fires all its drivers in Washington. And young people in South Sudan seeking change are thought to embrace non-violence mechanism.
The youth can play a great role in ending violent extremism. One is to inform the grassroots youth who are not aware of their rights, who are being dragged into the conflict or to the war that they have no idea about.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's embassy in Washington fired all of its drivers, according to Manyok Lual, a former embassy driver who now drives Uber for a living. Manyok stayed for more than 9 months without being paid by the embassy. He said yesterday he received part of his payment. The decision impacts 5 drivers in all, including one that was stationed at the ambassador's residence. Earlier this week, South Sudan's chargé d'affaires at the embassy, Gordon Boy, posted pictures on his personal Facebook page with a caption that said he was signing checks to pay local staff. No other details were given. Our reporter in Washington attempted to reach the embassy for comments and confirmation, but repeated calls have gone unanswered. Embassy employee asked our reporter Ayen Dengbior to set up an appointment, but did not pick up official embassy line. Ayen joins me now in the studio after just returning from the South Sudan embassy this past hour. Ayen, what did you see when you went to the embassy this morning?
Well, Tanza, this is a story that we've been following closely, and the details that you just mentioned are emerging, but so far we have been unable to get the embassy's side of the story. And that's why I went to the embassy this morning. I wanted to speak directly with an ambassador to give me the current details of the story. I waited for about 45 minutes, and Gordon Boy did not show up. I was told that he was in a meeting, and he was actually not in the office. I also spoke with two people who told me that in the future I should make an appointment. I tried to call the embassy to set up that appointment. Unfortunately, no one picked up the phone line. But I will continue to pursue the story.
But you are a common visitor there at the embassy. You've been going there for several times. Has it ever happened that they prevent you from going upstairs?
No, and that's actually what surprised me. And I actually asked one of the employees if this is a new thing, because as you just mentioned, I have gone there as a journalist.
And as a South Sudanese.
And as a South Sudanese as well. So I have gone there before. This is the first that I've heard that I should make an appointment.
And so what are you hearing from other sources? What is going on at the embassy there?
Well, you know what? I spoke to Gordon Boy a couple of weeks ago, who told me that, yes, they do have issues with money and they are trying to pay the embassy staff. But several people have quit the working at the embassy because they were unable to go unpaid. I have people close to me who just could no longer go any longer without getting paid. They have card notes, they have rent that needs to get paid, and they had to make the decision to leave the embassy. But it's no secret that the embassy has issues with money.
Thanks, Ayen. That's reporter Ayen Dengbior speaking to us about what is happening at the South Sudan Embassy here in Washington. The embassy fired 5 of its drivers this week. Youth activists in South Sudan say young people must fight for their political rights and civic rights through peaceful means. The activists spoke up at a 2-day workshop on how to end violent extremism. They say young people who engage in armed struggle, both on the government and opposition sides, must be shown an alternative, that is, non-violence. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Juba.
Ayak Choldeng is with the Anataban Arts Initiative, a youth movement for social change. Deng says Peace activists have got to persuade young people engaged in the conflict to choose peaceful means if they're going to make a difference in South Sudan.
We can see where violence has taken us as a country. We can see where we have looked at violence as the only option, how far we have regressed as a people, where we are economically. If we look at where we are in regards to literacy levels, development-wise, you know, in general, we have really regressed. All our intellectual people have left the country. We have a huge brain drain. All this is as a result of the violence.
Deng says young people between the ages of 15 and 35 make up the majority of South Sudan's population and so too comprise the majority of fighting forces for the warring parties. She says, with that in mind, youth should embrace the rule of law as the one and only channel for seeking justice.
Sensitizing our young people, fellow youth, on what legal channels they're there for us to advocate for our right. Understanding what legal instrument protects us as young activists to agitate for for our rights, be it at international level, be it at regional level, even within the constitution, our rights, you know, to protest, to agitate for civic engagement is guaranteed. Once we know these rights, we do not need to resort to violence.
Daniel Mwoka works for Youth Action for Community Transformation. He says many young people join the various armed groups because they think they can get a financial benefit out of it. Mwoka says other young people choose violence because they see it as the only means of addressing their political grievances. But he says it doesn't have to be that way.
The youth can play a great role in ending violent extremism. One is to inform the grassroots youth who are not aware of their rights, who are being dragged into the conflict or to the war that they have no idea about. So one thing of ending it is to keep our youth informed. Because if our youth are informed, they'll know what they're getting into. Because most of the youth right now, they're getting into something that they don't know who has caused it or what's the end result.
Kide Christine works for the local nonprofit Agency for Transformation and Development. She says the workshop, which brought together different youth activists with a regional expert from Somalia, is a great way to help young people share their experiences on achieving their goals through nonviolence. Christine says South Sudanese youths need to fight South Sudan's culture of violence.
What the youth can do is exactly what we've done today. Partnership, we make allies inside the country and outside. We share ideas and experiences, most especially like our colleague coming from a similar context like ours. You know, such experiences give us greater ideas and better options to address our issues other than violence.
Florence Justin, a community mobilizer at the Organization for Nonviolence and Development, says she works with youth on how to overcome ethnic and tribal differences, which she says is the first step to ending violence.
Awareness raising on nonviolence in peace building, and how can we now come together, regardless of our differences, so that we can be able to have a common identity that can identify us as a South Sudanese. And interfaith dialogue, we bring people from different religions and different backgrounds so that we dialogue together and see how the faith leaders can be able to play a great role towards bringing peace into the country.
The workshop also offered useful tips on healing from trauma caused by wars and conflicts. Ubale Isaac works with a local group called Youth Vision South Sudan, which provides psychosocial support for people affected by war.
We have small workshops which are supported by other organizations. But actually, there are also some of the challenges that we also have. Like, we realize that the government are not interested in whatsoever we are doing. Then we also lack access to other decision makers, both to the government and other international NGOs.
Organizers of the High-Level Revitalization Forum aimed at reviving the 2015 peace agreement in South Sudan have granted the nation's youth 35% participation at the table, something young activists call a good start. The third and final high-level forum is scheduled to get underway later this month. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio. Njoba.
Still on youth, the spread of fake news into the news circle across sub-Saharan Africa is causing widespread concern among news organizations and the general public. The U.S. State Department, through the Bureau of International Information Programs, is taking action with a media literacy awareness campaign targeting over 500,000 young people in Africa. From Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
The two-month-long campaign was launched on April the 2nd as the world marked International Fact-Checking Day. U.S. officials say the digital effort will target the public, including members of the Young African Leaders Initiative, or YALI. The network, established by former President Barack Obama in 2013, is an effort to invest in the next generation of African leaders. Christine Nidler is the YALI network coordinator.
This campaign started online, Facebook, Twitter, and, you know, it's part of a year-long campaign for the embassy here in Kenya. It's asking our network members to stop. When you see information, before you share it, stop. Reflect. Think about what you're going to share and verify to see if it's true. And on April 2nd, International Fact-Checking Day, the YALI Network campaign launched Africa-wide to more than 500,000 of our network members.
The campaign, titled hashtag YALI Checks, Stop, Reflect, Verify, is designed to sensitize the public and counter the spread of false news. It will provide a mix of online activities, including an email series, an online quiz, blog posts, online chats, public outreach, educational videos, and online pledges. According to media analysts, fake news is eroding confidence in the media. Caro Kimutai is the head of digital platforms at the Standard Group, one of Kenya's leading media houses.
So everything is a rumor until verified. Even if I see it on, you know, on a reporter's page and have to cross-check. Because like I said, when I started, we're in the business of trust. And if trust is broken, we are in a very complex situation with our audience.
In recent months, content from non-credible news sources and sophisticated videos masquerading as legitimate newscasts have influenced people's socio-political opinions in different countries across Africa. Mark Kaigwa, the founder of a Nairobi-based digital tech research company, Nendo, explains.
WhatsApp, according to Nendo, has over 12 million users in the country. That makes it, even though it is an instant messaging application, it makes it the battleground for facts, for information, for breaking news. So for us, the one set of prescriptive tips, it depends on the actual platform where you consume and get your news from. And WhatsApp, just by sheer numbers, it is close to twice the size of Facebook. It is 12 times the size of Twitter. So it is a key section of the digital population.
The Kenyan Parliament is also taking action. It's considering a new law, the Computer and Cybercrimes Bill of 2017, that would outlaw the spread of false news. Some fear the government could use the law to stifle the flow of information, including criticism of human rights abuses and graft. Robin Jogu is a news editor with a local radio station in Nairobi. He supports legal efforts to control the problem, but acknowledges that passing effective legislation may be a case of trial and error.
The digital sphere is evolving too fast. So sometimes we pass that law and we know the processes that it takes to pass a new law. Before that, things will have really changed. In the process of coming up with new laws, the government will always try and come up with things that will compromise the media freedom.
But the YALI-driven campaign is urging young African leaders to stop, reflect, and verify before forwarding what could be fake news. Nidler is calling on more people to join the campaign.
Make that pledge. Take the pledge. It costs you nothing, but it's saying, hey, I want to be a part of stopping and identifying misinformation. So,
according to the campaign organizers, there have been a total of over 10,000 pledges to hashtag stop, reflect, verify before responsibly sharing the information. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at maternal health in South Sudan. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Do you have a quick temper? Explain.
Yes, I do. I do. I'm so short-tempered. Something small just pisses me off, and I feel like reacting, fighting, replying back in a bad way.
Yes, I do, but I quickly forgive. So my temper is a harmless one.
About the quick temper, it's there, but you need to find ways of how to control it, because you may react to something which is small, then you turn into something big.
I don't have a quick temper. Reason is that I do understand everybody will or suggestion.
I don't have a quick temper because I always patient and I look at myself before I do. I temper myself. That's why I don't have the quick temper at all.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Today is World Health Day, and this year's theme is universal healthcare. Some countries have already made significant gains towards providing their citizens with universal health coverage, but half of the world's population, including those in South Sudan, are still unable to obtain the health services they need. Health experts in South Sudan say although the maternal mortality rate has gone down in recent years, huge challenges remain. For VOA News, Wake, Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
The Sudan household census taken in 2008, the last census gathered by the government, indicates there were 2,054 deaths per 100,000 births in South Sudan. Dr. Susie Francis Paul, a medical officer at the World Health Organization's Maternal Child Department in South Sudan, says the mortality rate has been reduced to 789 deaths per 100,000 births. Dr. Paul says South Sudan's fatality rate of 3.6% has reduced to less than 1%, but the widespread lack of access to contraceptives is still a big problem in the country.
Complications of abortions is very high in South Sudan. It's about 42%, and then it's followed by bleeding during pregnancy, and also obstructed labor and infections. The reason why we are having a lot of complications of abortions is because of the unmet need for contraceptives. There are many ladies who want contraceptives, but the thing is, because of cultural practices, they are not allowed or not don't have access to contraceptives.
Dr. Paul says some pregnant women across South Sudan still travel 100 kilometers to access health services. The United Nations Population Fund has provided programs for improving the reproductive health system in South Sudan. Speaking at a one-day media forum organized by the South Sudan Media Network for Population and Development, Dr. James Wanyama, acting country director of the UN Population Fund in South Sudan, says UNFPA has been building infrastructure, training midwives and nurses, and buying medicine and equipment for distribution across the country.
The needs are still very huge, but this is something we'll continuously work on with other partners to scale up, to ensure everyone is able to access these services.
Repent Kamis heads the South Sudan Nurses and Midwives Association. He says there are about 950 trained nurses and midwives across the country, but health workers in South Sudan still face many challenges.
Some of the working condition is not so conducive, so it also frustrates them. Another is the issue of late salaries that really demotivates nurses and midwives from doing their job as required. So most of the nurses now tend to do some other private jobs so that they can at least earn a living.
South Sudan 2017-2018 fiscal year budget is 46 billion South Sudanese pounds. Less than 2% of the budget is allocated to the Ministry of Health. Dr. Alexander Dimiti is the Director for Reproductive Health at the South Sudan Ministry of Health. Dr. Dimiti says funding allocated to his ministry is shared by 9 directorates, and although the budget is small, the ministry plans to address reproductive health challenges across the country.
We have put in place the reproductive health policy and the
policy has been transformed into a reproductive health strategy, which identifies all the strategies that we are using. And then in addition to that, we have a family planning a policy. But basically, for us to be able to achieve delivery on these policies in terms of implementation, we need the human resources. And you know that the issue of human resources has been a problem.
According to the WHO standard, 23 nurses, midwives, and 23 doctors are supposed to serve a population of 10,000 people. Dr. Dimity says in South Sudan, at least 20 doctors are allocated for 10,000 people, and only 15 nurses and midwives are allocated for every 10,000 people. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
South Sudan's Minister of Agriculture is applauding farmers in the former Western Equatoria for producing their own food despite the ongoing conflict. Addressing hundreds of citizens in Yambio Town on Wednesday, Onyoti Adigo encouraged farmers to increase production during this rainy season to avoid hunger in the future. Yambio farmers say it is difficult for them to cultivate in an insecure environment and called on the government to open roads for easy access to markets. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Juba.
In his speech to Yambio farmers and citizens during a 2018 agricultural campaign, Agriculture Minister Onyoti Adigo Nyikwach stressed the importance of improving food security in South Sudan. Speaking in Arabic, Adigo admitted the nation's economy is in a free fall, which means local farmers must work extra hard to produce more to feed the South Sudanese people.
Our economy has now collapsed and prices are high in the market. All this because we are not engaged in farming and many of our citizens are lazy to do so. But what I heard from Yambio is that no one is hungry in the town. That is why I came to launch this campaign here in Yambio. The time has come to all South Sudanese to cultivate.
The Minister of Agriculture launched the campaign to encourage farming communities across the country to produce more food to avert looming humanitarian crisis in the country. The latest food security reports estimate that 7.1 million people in South Sudan will face acute food insecurity between May and July. Pierre Vauthier is the deputy country representative for UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO. He says his office will continue to help South Sudanese farmers become more self-sufficient in food production.
We need to have all the population able to plant on time. We are blessed by the early rain, and I think it's very important. Let's hope it's going to go ahead like that. And FAO is standing with the government of South Sudan, with the farmers, in order to manage this season and to reverse this trend of having an increased gap of food.
Abel Sudan is a managing director of Baikwa Farmers, a multi-purpose cooperative society which has over 140 farmers. Sudan says the ongoing conflict has especially affected food production in parts of the former Western Equatoria state.
We were afraid of abduction. They can come and get these young men, these young ladies. So it hindered our plans and our activities that we were doing. But currently this year, we have resorted to cash crops.
Butrus Samuel Muhammad is a member of Baikwa Cooperative Society. Speaking in Arabic, Muhammad urges the government to open up roads so that farmers can take their food to markets in other parts of South Sudan.
Earlier on, we used to access roads to Wau and Juba, and we used to sell our crops there. But since 2015, we can no longer have access to those roads. We have varieties of seeds here like groundnuts, maize, and others, but local people cannot buy. The only hope we have is on the organizations who could come and buy it from us. Let them come and buy from us and take it to some areas that lack seeds.
The World Food Program's deputy country representative, Simon Kamal Beck, says the food security situation in South Sudan continues to deteriorate and encourage farmers to take advantage of the upcoming planting season to produce more food. The former Western Equatoria state falls within the Green Belt, fertile agricultural areas of South Sudan, with its thick forests providing moisture and rainfall throughout the year. Before Sudan's 21 year of civil war, which ended in 2005, the area was considered the breadbasket of then southern Sudan. Farmers in the area grew rice, maize, coffee, and cotton, which was sold to the Nzara textile factory located in Nzara County. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Former South African President Jacob Zuma appeared in court today to face corruption charges. The appearance was brief but significant, coming just under 2 months after his resignation. Addressing supporters outside the courthouse, Zuma criticized the charges as politically motivated. Thuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Innocent until proven otherwise.
These were the words of former President Jacob Zuma on Friday, speaking after his appearance at the Durban High Court to face charges of fraud, racketeering, corruption and money laundering. Earlier, a defiant Zuma smiled and waved to hundreds of his supporters as he entered the building. In court, the prosecution told Judge Themba Sishi that they've agreed with the defense to postpone the case until June 8th. The postponement was mainly to give Zuma a chance to finalize his review application, objecting to the decision to recharge him. Zuma was not asked to plead or pay bail, with the judge only warning him to appear on the next court date. Andile Mkutama was one of the Zuma supporters who prayed, sang and danced outside the court.
We are here to stand with the president of the people. We will stand with President Zuma now and will stand with him until the land returns. Hands off Zuma!
For many South Africans, seeing the former president in the dock was somehow unbelievable. Sizakele Dlamini says it's a positive development in African democracy.
It is the norm in African countries that former presidents or current presidents who break the law, they are led to go scot-free. South Africa has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that it's doable, it can be done.
Zuma's party, the African National Congress, has decided not to support him during his court battle. However, some ANC members came out to support him Friday, saying they were doing so on their own. Political analyst Karima Brown says this could be a big blow for Zuma.
I think this is a man deeply at odds with his own organization. Now, for someone like Jacob Zuma, who's been in the African National Congress for over 65 years, that is a deep, deep wound.
The charges relate to kickbacks Zuma allegedly received in connection to a European arms deal undertaken by South Africa in the 1990s. A representative for the French arms dealer, Thales S.A., is facing charges that are similar to Zuma's. Zuma first appeared in court for the same charges in 2007. They were dropped in 2009 by the Democratic Alliance Party convinced the court to reinstate them, leading to Friday's appearance. As usual, Zuma supporters demanded that he sings his trademark songs Friday, and he did not disappoint. Thuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
That report by Thuso Kumalo in Johannesburg brings us to the end of our show for this Friday. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Have a peaceful weekend and thank you for allowing us into your homes and vehicles. We would like to know what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Our Facebook name is South Sudan in Focus. Join us on Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.